South Texas.
Martha, you asked me to tell you something about my life and when I was born and about the conditions of the time when I was a child. I was born August the 19th, 1904 in San Antonio. And I lived here for 3 years, and then my mother died. And as I was the fifth child in this family, we were all sent to Austin to be with my grandmother, Fanning, and her mother, Mrs. Susan Edla Sneed. Morgan, I should say. Her maiden name was Sneed. My great-grandmother's parents came to Texas in 1848, and her father was a judge, and he bought up a whole city block in Austin, Texas, on what is called Pease Street. And of course he sold off part of it, and part other buildings were on there when I went to Austin. But the old family home was a large cream color brick, a two-story affair. And I remember as a child, I used to marvel at the high ceilings in that home, because in the little house we lived in next door, the ceilings were just normal. But at that one, and when you would eat in the dining room, the ceilings to a child was just way, way, way up. And of course, in those days, there were no screens to keep out the flies. And there were no fans either. But over the dining table, I can remember hanging an oblong wooden frame with long, long fringes of pink paper. And now you wouldn't think a child could remember pink paper, would you? Well, I was about four or between four and five, And there was a small darky. We called anyone who was colored in those days a darky. And this child was sitting over against, with his back against the wall, and he had a rope, and he was pulling this back and forth and back and forth over the table, keep the flies away and to kind of cool us off, I guess. But of course, being a child, I was very curious, and I had to investigate what he was doing, and I had to go and talk to him and find out how he did that. And it was no trick at all to do it. It wasn't heavy or anything. You just pulled it with regularity back and forth. But my father brought us back to San Antonio after my youngest brother, a baby that was born after I was, after he died. And one thing, if you remember when I was talking to you about what happened way, way back yonder, he bought a car here in San Antonio. He bought this red car, and it didn't have a top on it. It was fire red, I can remember that. It had two seats, very square looking, and black leather upholstery. And, well, it was about a 1907 or a 1908 car. And so being so young and not knowing everything and being curious, I would stand up beside him as he was taking us around in Austin, driving around. And I had two brothers older than I and two sisters older than I. And the boys were very mechanically minded. And, of course, they asked him all kinds of questions about this car. And they said, what kind of a car was it? And he said it was a black. And I had my arm around his neck, and I said, oh, but that couldn't be. It was a red. That's right. I didn't know, I didn't know about Fords and things like that, other cars, other makes of cars. But we came back to San Antonio, and he had this car, oh, until about 1912. And then, we came on the train. The family came, the brothers and this, my two older sisters brought me on the train. And I always wondered, we had an old square piano. I don't know whether you've ever seen a real square piano, but we had a square piano up in Austin that the two older sisters took lessons. They took piano lessons. And, of course, it must have weighed a ton. And I could hear the conversation going back and forth. Of course, I was a child and didn't get to say very much because the older ones were always out talking me. And they said, oh, we were going to have a piano in San Antonio. And I just couldn't imagine how that heavy, heavy piano was ever going to get to San Antonio. I didn't realize that you could put furniture on a train, you know, and bring it. But when we moved into the house, and it was just simply a rent house, it was not, we didn't own it. On Perry Street, I remember so well, it was about a block from the railroad tracks. And right across the street from us was a fire station. And they had horses in those days.
Oh, boy.
They didn't have any motors. There were absolutely no motor fire trucks at all in San Antonio. And, oh, those horses were so well trained that the minute we could always hear these bells across the street, you know. And, of course, kids would always be out in the yard, but everyone had a fence around their yard in those days. No children ran the streets. And we could see these horses back into their harness. Oh, they were so well trained, the firemen didn't have to do anything. And somehow the harness would just fall down on them. I think it must have, maybe they touched something with their back or something, but it automatically fell on them, and the firemen just buckled one or two things, and off they were. Well, of course, it was very exciting. But not for me, because I was always the tidbit of the family, you know. But the two brothers, oh, they just couldn't stand it, and especially the older brother. Oh, he'd run to fires if he could. Now, we lived about three blocks from what is now the Missouri Pacific Depot. It was brand new in those days, and it was beautiful. And my brother and I would go up there, and we'd go up the stairs and all around the mezzanine. We called it the mezzanine. I don't know whether they did, but that's what we did. And the stained glass windows were so beautiful, you know, and we were brought up to enjoy and, conscious of anything artistic or beautiful. And to this very day, I have a large magnifying glass that comes from my great-grandmother's brother. And he was some sort of a naturalist. He had a doctor but in front of his name, but I don't remember. I know he wasn't a physician. He wasn't a medical doctor or that kind. He had another, and someplace in the house I have the picture of him standing with this particular magnifying glass that I have. Well, we used to use this glass to look at stones. In our day, our streets were not paved. They had rocks in them, and all kinds of rocks. And we would bring them home and get a brush and wash them off real good, you know, and let them dry. And some of the very large rocks, did you know that you could break them and that on the inside of them they would have crystals?
I've seen that, yes.
Uh-huh. We just were a family who wanted to know the facts about everything. And we would get flowers or blades of grass or little seeds on weeds and look at it underneath this magnifying glass. And, we get snail shells, you know. And, of course, we always had shells because someone was always going to Galveston or Corpus bringing shells to us, you know. And we looked at that, and just grains of sand underneath the magnifying glass is just out of this world. You know, it transports a child. It really does. It transports them into another world. In fact, I think all of my life I've lived in another world, not particularly this one, but it was just a world that God made. Just a world that was everything, every shrub and every flower. When we were children, as we walked to town, and we only lived 6 blocks from town, we were taught these things by our elders, even if it was just a cousin. It didn't matter. They were always telling us the names of different trees and different shrubs. And I remember when I was in high school and I did take botany, the teacher always said, "Where in the world did you know, where did you find out all of these things?" And I said, "Well, I've always known them, I guess." And that is true. When you are made aware of things when you are very small, and I've tried to do this with my own daughter, Carol Joy, and also with my grandchildren, even the latest grandchild, little Mark. I used to take him all over Highland Park here, and every flower, we would go up people's driveways, and I would show him flowers. But to get back to my early days, I started to school when I was 7 years old, and I was born in 1904, so that means that I started to what is now called Sarah King School, but in my day was called Number 9, and it is over on the west side. Now, today, I don't know where it is. I mean, I don't know the street it's on, but it's still there. And the reason I know that is when I went to get my Social Security, they found my records at that school when I started to school there, and I had no idea that they kept school records, did you? I certainly didn't know that that would happen. But anyway, we had a long way to walk to that school. And, of course, I was the baby of the family, and The brother next to me was in school 2 years before I ever went to school. So what to do with this one little kid that was left at home with no mother? So they farmed me out, I always say that, they farmed me out to different cousins. There was one aunt and an uncle who lived out on the north side, which of course is now in our city limits, but in our day it was country, it was way out in the country. And he had 2 grown children at home. All the rest of his children were grown and married, and so they'd love to have a little kid at their house, you know. So I went there. Well, this Uncle George and I just didn't get along very well. Oh, he was a giant. He was about 6'4", and he loved me. I'm certain of that. He really liked me very much, and to show it, he'd pick me up and throw me up till my head would touch the ceiling of the room, and it would frighten me to death. And then he teased me a great deal, and of course, being without a mother and not having any true love, anyone to ever just put their arm around me and squeeze me and love me, I didn't have that kind of a childhood. My childhood was, I guess, a little hard, but must have been very hard for my 2 older sisters, because they really had the responsibility of the cooking and the washing and taking care of the house. But when it was time for me to go to school, well, the first day I went, of course, I just went with the family, and they put me in the first grade. And this is hard to believe, because none of my own child and none of my grandchildren have I taught the way I was taught. But the reason for that was that anything that my older sisters and my older brothers knew, I knew. Because we sat around a table at night doing our lessons. And of course, before I went to school, I learned, before I ever went to the first grade, I knew the times tables, the complete times tables through 12. I knew all of the 48 states, their capitals, their rivers, and their industries. So I must have been walking book of knowledge, you know. Yeah. Well, in this school, I stayed in there one day because I could write and I could print. So they didn't keep me in that first grade. So they put me in the high first, and I started in the high first and stayed there. Because in those days, unfortunately, I was very small for my age. Well, I skipped every other grade, and I caught my brother, 2 years older than I, in the fourth grade. I skipped the high third and went into the fourth. Poor thing, he had never skipped. But I knew how he felt about it. He was hoping that I wouldn't skip, because going to school, we talked this over, going back and forth. And he loved me, and I loved him very much, and I didn't want to hurt his feelings. I knew that that would hurt his feelings. And, oh, I was just hoping I wouldn't skip. But sure enough, here I walk into his room. And he saw me walk in, and he got up out of his desk and walked to me and I to him with our arms outstretched. And we fell in each other's arms, and both of us just crying madly. Well, the teacher said, what was the matter? And of course, my brother was blubbering, and he never was much of a talker anyway. And he wouldn't say anything. And I said, well, Ross did not want me in the class with him. And so the teacher said, well, have you ever skipped before, Ross? And he said, no, ma'am. And she looked at his grades, and she said, well, you are right now. So she skipped him, and we stayed together, just a half a grade behind each other, all the way through school. And but this is something that I think could come back into, or at least I think it's important, is teaching children very young languages. And in the fifth grade, you could take Spanish. Or you could take German. Are they doing it again? In the fifth grade? Uh-huh.
Yes, they start them out now.
Well, they're not up here at Highland Park.
They do.
Uh-huh. Well, so my brother took Spanish, naturally. San Antonio is a Spanish community a great deal, and particularly on the west side of San Antonio in those days when I was young. But they were in school with us, but we never paid any attention to whether they were Mexicans or Spaniards or whatever. We were just trying to learn a language. Did I ever tell you that that little story about when I couldn't have been more than eight? I'm sure I wasn't more than eight. My Yankee grandmother, that was the one from Illinois, but she was living in Texas now, because she brought my uncles and my father all across from Illinois to Texas. She and her husband were workers on the railroad. They had teams of mule teams and wagons, and they brought up these ties, these railroad ties. Uh-huh. And you see, my father was about 12 years younger than his oldest brother. And that's the reason that he was the baby of his family. So my father was brought to Texas in about 1885 or something like that. But anyway, this Yankee grandmother, whenever she would come to San Antonio, she always came in before Thanksgiving. And then she would stay until Easter, she and my grandfather. Now, they had a goat ranch out Columbus, out toward Houston?
Yes, there's a Columbus out there.
Well, I know they had, is it Columbus County or is it their Columbus City? They didn't live in the city. They didn't live. They lived in Groveton, because that's where they're both buried. But anyway, they drove that. Now, this is something that an experience that I never knew any other child to have, you know, is to have kinfolks who would come to see them in these, what do you call them, Conestoga? Wagon? Those big bowed wagons with canvas over the top? Conestoga, I think. Well, anyway, the uncle, her second son, was a widower, and he lived with them and took care of the goat ranch for them. But he would come that way, and they would come on the train. And when they would come on the train, they would come in a carriage.
Oh boy.
They didn't have taxi cabs, you know.
Yeah.
And there would be two horses to a carriage. And then on the back, everyone traveled with a trunk. And oh, that trunk was very, very fascinating to my brother and I. I suppose it was fascinating to all of them, but kids, you know, kids always had their nose in everything. And we were kind of small, so as long as we didn't talk and as long as we didn't disturb the elders, they didn't bother us. But occasionally they did send us out, and they would say, small pitchers have big ears, and out we would go. If they were talking about grown-up talk that we could gossip and go tell the neighbors or go tell some of the relatives, well, if we weren't supposed to hear it, out we went. But for this advent of the trunk, oh, that was something. My grandmother just seemed to know what children would like, you know. It never was big things, but she'd have things tucked away in certain trays. And have you ever seen any of these old-fashioned trunks, these bowed kind? Well, we have one over in Carol Joy's attic, you know, that is my grandmother's. But they had a place, different layers in there where you could lay dresses out because no one had any closets. You know, you either hung your clothes on nails in the walls, or you put a piece of board up and hung them that way. There were no coat hangers. I don't remember any coat hangers until, I must have surely been 13 or 14 years old before I remember coat hangers. But anyway, everything was in this trunk. Well, she might have a little stick of peppermint candy tucked here, just one, you know, and of course, two little hands coming up. Well, she'd give whichever hand got there first. But there were, I can't remember, she'd bring us a different kind of nuts that we didn't have here in San Antonio. Particularly, she always brought chestnuts. Now, chestnuts, we did not like. But chestnuts we ate as long as she was with us. And then she brought peanuts, and that was something that we didn't have. Now they're all around us in the down in the south part, you know. No, nobody planted peanuts there. They must have, I don't know whether they planted them for these goats or what. I don't know. But they were tiny, tiny little pea things, you know.
Yes.
And we would put them in the oven and roast them, and then get all of that covering off and eat them. Oh, and we made peanut brittle, and, you know, from way, way back, we did things like that. But she also would bring sorghum molasses.
Oh.
And if you know what sorghum molasses is, that's real black. Oh, it's so thick you can just hardly get it out. Well, we had a very strict rule in our family. By this time, my father had gotten a adult cousin to come and live with us. And although she worked downtown, she had an office downtown, she did try to bring some semblance of order in our home, you know. And so we always had our table just set just properly. And by that, I mean the silver was placed exactly as we place it today. And that was unusual in those days. Almost everybody just threw their silverware, or they didn't even use silverware. They used what we call steak knives now.
Yes.
And they had forks that looked just like it. They had the, but we just didn't have it. We simply didn't have it. And so we weren't allowed to do that. Well, when my poor grandfather, by that time, he must have been about 75 years old. And he had been a very rugged individual, you know. And probably when I think back on it now, when I think back on him coming from Illinois and doing all of that hard, hard labor. Probably he didn't have any time for any social amenities. You know, and I think it was a little hard on him. It wasn't hard on my grandmother Townsend. She had no, she liked nice things, you know. But, for instance, my grandfather would pour his hot coffee in a saucer and drink it that way. He wouldn't drink it out of the cup. We never did understand that, because my father drank coffee, and he drank out of a cup. But if we children, after the grandfather would leave, we had tea. We never had coffee. I never drank coffee until after I was married. So he would... we would try to drink our tea. You know, sometimes tea is very hot, and so we'd put it in the saucer. And I can remember this because I was very young, and put it in the saucer and blow on it a little bit to cool it off, you know. And about that time, my cousin would say, "Marie, what are you doing?" So I'd say, I always just said nothing. Of course, you could see more than that. Well, we couldn't understand why, if elders could do things, why we couldn't do them. And it wasn't, we just weren't allowed to do. In other words, it was do as I say do, not as I do. It went back that far. But while we were living on this street, this Perry Street, we must have lived there about 3.5 years before we moved more over into the midtown part of San Antonio.
How many people were living in San Antonio at that time?
Oh, I don't know. Not very many. It was a very small town. Almost all of us, we knew all of the families. Wherever child went, why, they were always saying,
"Everybody knows somebody else."
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I found that, up until I got married in 1923, we still knew every person that lived on our route to town.
What kind of transportation did they have through town? Streetcars or?
Well, we had streetcars down a block from where we lived on this Perry Street. Oh, and that is something I must tell you. Way back in those days, now this was before 1910, when there were any prisoners in the jail, they weren't allowed to do as we do now, give them television and give them radios and good food and keep the air conditioning and all of that now. But in those days, if you were a prisoner, you had a ball and chain on your leg, and you went out on the streets and you crushed rocks with great big sledgehammers. And I know my brother and I used to sit and watch these people down on Medina Street. Mm-hmm. And they would hit these rocks, and then they would have to shovel them to fix the streets. And then they had big rollers that two or three of them would have to get on to smooth it out. There was no mechanical.
All by hand.
Yes, ma'am. And I used to feel, of course, being a girl, I'd feel very sorry for them, you know. And there were all kinds. There were colored Negro people, or there were Mexicans, or there were white people. It didn't make any difference if they were a prisoner. They had to get out and work on the streets. And that's the way a good many of San Antonio's early streets were made. Now, there were just about 3, I guess, streetcar lines in those days. No, there was 4. There was one on Medina, one on Flores, one on Main Avenue, and then one out Commerce Street. And it went from one end of Commerce to the other. But now, when I think, I can remember funerals, for instance, way, way back yonder. There were no cars to go to them. Hearses, they called them hearses. They were drawn by horses, and they were black, and they had plate glass on both sides. Oh, they were very fancy, and fluted drapery on it. You know, it was attractive. Really, it was attractive. It wasn't bad, but people walked for miles to go to a cemetery. I can remember so well when later on, when we in the 1910-1914 era and 1916, we were more in a political situation, you know, where we cared who the mayor was or cared who the district attorney was or something like that. And then when people would die, they would walk from Porter Loring down on Jefferson Street all the way out to Commerce, to the city cemetery out here on Commerce Street. And that's a long, long way. That surely is. Oh, I know something I really forgot to tell you. And this is very important because you can see it. But we, in San Antonio, while we still had horse-drawn fire trucks, we finally got a chemical fire truck. And this particular chemical fire truck, to this very day, is right out in the Woody Museum.
Is that right?
And I have seen that chemical, we called it the chemical engine, driven by a man by the name of Phil Wright, who later became our police and park commissioner. But at that time, he was driving these 4 white horses in front of this beautiful... Oh, it was. And it was so exciting, and it made so much noise because it was puffing. Now, what it really did, I don't know. But it was a new invention. And then I also remember when the first hook and ladder, you know, where those long... But by that time, we had gotten... this must have been about 1910, where we did get motors. Now, what kind of cars, I mean, what kind of engines they were, I don't know. But down right now where we have Sears Roebuck on Romana Plaza, right out in the middle of that plaza, when I was a child, was a big fire station. And, of course, it doesn't look anything like it did when I was a child, being as the whole Sears is there, you know, took up a beautiful home that was there in those days. But then is when we got the motorized fire trucks.
You know what year that was?
No, I could only say it must have been between 1910-1912. I'm not so sure about the year. But it seems to me that I remember you saying to me, ever see an Indian? Do I know anything about Indians? Well, actually, I didn't know anything about Indians. Here in San Antonio, we didn't have Indians. Or if we did, I never saw them. Except when Buffalo Bill came here. Now, Buffalo Bill, his real name, of course, was William Cody. And he was my great-grandmother's nephew. And so he came here to San Antonio when I was about six, I guess. And he was right between us and this Missouri Pacific Depot, which was called in those days the INGN. International? No, Illinois Gulf? I don't remember. INGN. All I can remember. But Buffalo Bill came, and so, of course, my brothers and my two older sisters and my daddy all wanted to go to see this Wild West show that Buffalo Bill was going to have. They knew who Buffalo Bill was. I didn't know who Buffalo Bill was. I mean, in those days, I didn't know that Buffalo Bill was any relation to me. You know, I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it when he picked me up. But he picked me up. And he was the most beautiful man you ever looked at, or at least I thought he was. But he had the prettiest blue eyes and the whitest hair and the whitest beard. So you know who I thought he was. I thought he was Santa Claus. I was young enough to believe in Santa Claus. So, but he had on a white hat, and all of his, everything that he had on was white, but it was made of deer skin. Oh, he just beat it beautifully. So he kissed me on one cheek, and then he kissed me on the other, and he said, "That is from Aunt Sue." And, of course, I didn't know who Aunt Sue was because I had to wait until the family came home later. And I said, he kissed me again and told me it was from Aunt Sue. Well, who is Aunt Sue? Because I didn't know who Aunt Sue was. Well, and all of his Indians were around him.
How many?
Oh, there must have been 20 or 30. They were just thick. Oh, they were just squeezing into us. And they were touching me because I was a very golden-haired, blonde, blue-eyed, little red-cheeked, fair-skinned baby, you know, a little kid. And they touched me and touched my dress. And finally, of course, he was talking to them. He could talk their language. And all I thought I heard was just grunts and, you know. I don't know what I heard, but probably there were, how could he have answered? So I said, "What are they saying?" And he said, "Oh, they said, let's take her along with us." So, of course, the minute he sat me down, I took off for home without any brothers, without any sisters. I just had about two blocks to run. And I ran all the way home. And I went, and I had a little yellow rocking chair that I sat in. It was a tiny little child's chair, you know. And I got all my comfort from there. And when my family came home, they found me in my rocking chair. And they wanted to know why I ran away. They couldn't understand why I ran away, but I really was frightened.
Yes, so.
All of those, they were, when I think about it now, because I have seen Indians since, but his Indians were so clean and so, oh, their skins were reddish bronze. And, of course, he had this same group for years. You know, he really took his troop out to England, to France, to all over Europe. So they knew him, and he knew them very well. But you can see how it would actually frighten a child. But to get back to, we moved away from this neighborhood and went to a new school. And it was called Stephen F. Austin. And it was number two. Number two. And, of course, I had passed to the fifth grade, and I had my grade card, and I took it to the principal, and he looked at me, and he looked at that card, and he said, "Is this your name?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "How old are you?" And I said, "I'm 10. And he said, "Well, we don't have any 10-year-olds in our fifth grade." And he said, "Are you sure this is your grade card?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, what is your principal's name?" And I told him that it was this Sarah King, you know. So he called her, because I was very short and very small. I was about as tall as a bicycle, the bar leading across. They have pictures of me somewhere standing next to my brother's bicycle where I wasn't any taller than that. So you can imagine, he didn't want me in the fifth grade. Well, he called this principal, and she said, I could hear her laughing, because she was a teacher, a principal who just put back her head and laughed. And she said, "Oh, yes, you'll find out that you have something there." And so he said, "Well, that's all I wanted to know, whether she really belonged here." And so he said to me afterwards, he said, "Now, young lady, you're never going to be skipped again." He said, "It stunted your growth." So I really never was skipped again. But in the fifth grade there, I took German, because my brother took Spanish, and I saw no reason for taking the same thing that he did, because I knew everything that he did anyway. I had to listen to his lessons before he could go to school the next day. I had to know whether he knew his lesson or not.
Was there a lot of German spoken in San Antonio?
Well, not in this particular school, but yes, we had many. In fact, a little later on, I was in a very German neighborhood. Everyone on the street was German except us. And we were English, and of course, then there was a big two-story house next to us, and during the Mexican Revolution, that house was rented always to Mexican refugees. And we had several generals from Mexico living there during Carranza and what was the other man's name? Started with an M. I can't think of his name. But anyway, you remember Pancho Villa.
Yeah.
You heard of Pancho Villa.
Sure.
Well, of course, he was raiding the American side as well as the Mexican, the northern part of Mexico, you know. So my brother, who was not old enough to join the army, ran off and joined the army. And he was in Deming, I think, New Mexico. And he would write back, and, you know, I don't know a thing about this, but in New Mexico, it seems that there's, the border is just a barbed wire fence. There's no river right there. Now, on the Texas coast, we have the Rio Grande River, you know. But there in New Mexico, they didn't. So my brother was saying, well, you couldn't, how could you tell which side you were really on, whether you were in Texas or whether you were in Mexico? So that must have been something.
Yeah.
I'm mixing myself up a little here. I should have said they were in Deming, New Mexico, so they couldn't tell whether they were in New Mexico or in Old Mexico. That's what I should have said. But for a little, I don't remember how long this went on before my father was able to find out what had happened to my brother, where he was. But he did. He found out where he was exactly. And he got him out of the service because he wasn't old enough to be in the army. he was tall enough. He was over 6 feet tall, but he just didn't have the age. But, you know, to have lived in a place like this, we lived on this street, Slocum Place, and that is a street that was just all German family. And the German family who lived next door to us, they wouldn't even speak to us because we were English. And, of course, I had no actual encounters with Irish people, but there was parts in San Antonio that was called the Irish Flats, and that was over on 5th Street, and they were adobe houses, and they nearly always had a well. The reason I know this, I found it out later when I was in the Lutheran Church. And we owned a piece of property, an adobe house that was actually one of the original Irish flat places.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it had the well on the porch. And so, of course, since then, for many years, we used this small building as a Sunday school room or a fellowship room, fellowship building. We had a nice kitchen in it. But now we've made it into a parking lot. It's right downtown, you know, and so the little place is gone. But this is all before my time. They do say that the Irish and the Germans and the Greeks. We had a few Greeks and a few Syrians here. Now, I went to school with Greeks and Syrians, but they were very, very intelligent. They were smart as they could be. And all of the Spanish kids I went to high school with, they were studying French right along with me. So I myself had no racial trouble at all growing up. In fact, my grandmother used to think that this grandmother Townsend, she was always thought she came from Victoria. She always said that she could trace her ancestry back to Victoria, Queen Victoria. But I've never been able to find it that it goes there. Maybe I just don't know how to trace it. But we always thought she was a little bit hoity-toity. And every time that she did come to see us, and my grandfather, we also had another grandfather who was Confederate. And that's why I say we had a Yankee and a Confederate situation in our family, you know? And when I was very, very small, it used to hurt my feelings so, because they would get into discussions or arguments. They never got mad at one another, but it was always arguing the war, you know, the Confederate war. And so that hurt my insides, my heart so much. And one evening I went to bed. I remember this so well. My brother and I slept together. We had a youth bed that had little sides on it, and we always kneeled down to say our prayers at night, you know. So I knelt down and said my prayer that night, but I went to bed, and my brother, of course, he'd hit the bed and he could go to sleep and nothing flat. But I was sobbing and crying, and this grown cousin that was in charge of us, she must have heard me, and she came in. And she said, honey, what's the matter? And I said, I'm not Yankee, and I'm not Confederate. I'm not American. I'm just a Texan. Because I was born in San Antonio, and I felt like I was a Texan. And, you know, when Your mother wouldn't know anything about this, but we had theaters in way back yonder, and we had organs in these theaters, and they played to the silent films. And then in between the films, they would play patriotic airs, you know? And they always played, well, nobody ever played the Star Spangled Banner. They always played The Old Folks at Home or Dixie. And believe me, if you didn't stand up, the whole place had to stand up. And if you didn't stand up, there would be fights. Because the Southern element was here, up until 1914, until the First World War. And I remember so well that that I was in the high seventh. I was just about to graduate from elementary school. And this is something they don't do now either, and that's run extras, the papers. But we always had, when I was a child, we've always had the Light and the Express papers here. And when any new little thing came over the wire, well, they'd quick run out of, maybe it would just be five or six lines. But they'd call them extras, and they would sell them for 2 cents each. Can you imagine? And they'd have these boys running up and down the streets calling out extra. And when I was in class, this I will never forget. I was in class in the high seventh, and an extra was called. And, of course, at that time, Germany was just overrunning all of Europe, you know. And they, someone, I suppose one of the teachers went out and got an extra, and they came back in and they said war had been declared. The United States had declared war against Germany. And so, of course, in my class, I was 12 years old, and we had 16 and 18-year-old children in that class. I guess there may have been three or four who were 14, but they were all much older children than I, you know. I mean, they were adolescents, really. And here I was, a little 12-year-old, so you know what I did, don't you? I just put my head down on my desk and just cried and cried and cried, and I didn't know what war meant, you know. But it did upset me to think that the country that I was in was now going to war against a country that was across the Atlantic. And to me, that was about the farthest distance that you could imagine. But one of the happy times of my childhood, I was christened a Methodist as a baby, but then Travis Park Methodist was the only Methodist church in San Antonio at that time. And it was quite a distance away from home. And every time that we would go to Sunday school, well, we went every Sunday, but we went to Sunday school and we stayed for church. And by the time we'd walk home, it would be nearly 2 o'clock. And I always had a headache, and of course I was the smallest in the family, and it was hard for me to walk. We didn't, the others would walk faster than I, and I guess I was trying to keep up with them, I don't know. So my cousin decided that we should go to a church in the neighborhood, and it happened to be a Presbyterian. So we went to a Presbyterian in the neighborhood, and oh, I just loved to go to Sunday school. Oh, I just had more lovely experiences in learning God's Word. In our particular family, we read a chapter of the Bible every night. And so I have always studied the Bible, and I still have that same family Bible that we had. When I went to this, it was called Utica Presbyterian. It was on Poplar Street, and now it is the Woodlawn Presbyterian Church. But in those days, we walked up there, and it was just a little frame building. And there were no Sunday school rooms. You simply had your class in a pew. And I even remember my teacher's name. Now, you know that, you wouldn't think that you'd remember a teacher's name that you had way back. Her name was Miss Paisley. And I remember so many of, I didn't stay with that church, but I remember so many of that, of those names in that group. They were very, very active in missionary work. And so they had all of us bringing Sunday school members. And every time you brought a Sunday school member, you had a little fish pinned on you. And these fish, when I think of it now, to then it was very, very new. But they were out of cellophane paper or something, because they would sort of, you'd pin them on you and they'd wiggle. You know, the air or something, they were transparent, they were red, and they would wiggle. Well, every time that you brought a new member, you'd get one of these fish. Well, if you brought 10 new members, you received a Bible. And the first thing you received was a testament. So I received the New Testament, and it was a little small book. I have that to this very day. Then I brought 10 more members. They were neighborhood children. That's who I would get to come to Sunday school with me. And I received this Bible. And do you know that I even had that Bible until Carol Joy was, that's my daughter, you know, when she was going across the street to the Baptist Temple youth training, she was taking my old Bible, the first one that belonged to me, over there, and she wore it out over there. But, you know, when you look back on a long life, and this happened to me about 6 years ago, I read an obituary notice. And it was an Italian family that I had taken into this Presbyterian church. And the father was buried by the pastor of this Presbyterian church. And that was surprising to me, to think that there they had stayed all of those years with this particular Presbyterian church, but I hadn't, you know?
Yeah.
And they were Italian. Oh, they were the loveliest, most beautiful family that you ever knew. But their name was Caffarelli. And, they just had the most elegant home. I never saw such velvet curtains at the drapes at the windows, you know? And the girls, the two girls, Camilla and Dorothy, their beds were both up on a platform, and their bedspreads were just out of this world. Well, everything that they had was just gorgeous. But to think that after all of these years, I read that name, Caffarelli, and here they were still in the Presbyterian Church. But while I was in this Presbyterian Church, in the summertime, we had revivals. And they were right downtown where Smith Young Tower is now. And it was called Bowen's Island at that time. It was where the river backed up really a little bit there. course, the San Antonio River to this, right at this day, is nothing like it was when I was a child, you know. It's the courses have changed, so. But they had two revivalists, and they were called Ham and Ramsey. Ham, H-A-M. And all of the churches, all of the Christian churches in San Antonio had their regular Sunday school service and their regular morning service at their own church. And then in the evening, this was summertime now, we went in these, oh, it was a huge, huge tent. And the sides were up, and there were no electric fans. Everyone carried their own fan, or else they gave out little pasteboard fans. You know, they were souvenirs, sort of. And now when I see Billy Graham's big revivals, you know, it reminds me of me as a child. I always sang in the choir. And there I was with all of, nearly, there weren't too many children up there. There were mostly adults, you know. But I just loved to sing, and so I was singing my heart out, you know, just loving to sing. But these revivalists were very dramatic. It was things that wouldn't happen in your own church, you know, in your own pulpit. And sometimes they would bother me a little bit, because I didn't especially think that to have faith and to believe in God and to attend church and all of that, I didn't think religion meant all of this fanfare, you know, that they were doing. But evidently they brought in many people to the church, and then it was the local church's duty to incorporate them into their their regular way of doing, you know. And there were very few churches in San Antonio who had dramatic speakers. But this one church over on Main Avenue, which is still there, it's a new building now, but it was called the Central Christian Church. It was noted for dynamic speakers, and when we were children, we had to go there at night often to hear these dynamic speakers. I'm still of the opinion that any place, anywhere that you can go to hear anything, you are bound to get something good out of it. If you just get one good thing. In fact, I was brought up on that old saying that every day learn something new. Learn one thing, just one thing. And if you consider it, that would be 365 things a year. So think how many new things that you could learn.
That's right. You have just told so many things, Mrs. Wahlberger. Anything there on that list that you'd like to mention before you stop?
Well, I didn't say anything much about politics or politicians. But I had relatives who were very much in politics. And as a child, I had to sit at their rallies, I guess they call them rallies. And I had to sit and listen to them. They ran for various posts in San Antonio. I must say they never did win. But you had a fair sampling of what everyone had to say. For instance, the mayor would speak, and the different commissioners, the fire and police and the parks. That was something that I should have told you about. It was our beautiful Brackenridge Park. Because you wouldn't know what it was as when I was a child. It's in the same place that it was when I was a child, but of course things have changed over the years for the better, I must say. But when I was a child, it was strictly a family outing place. And several of our cousins and aunts and our own family, we might have as many as 50 people, would go out there in the evening. And this wouldn't satisfy people nowadays because everything must be done in a hurry, you know. But when I was a child, you had time to sit around, and the elders did, to talk, and the children to run and swing and play. But they would cook roasting ears, you know, boil them in wash tubs for the family. Can you imagine boiling that much? They would. They didn't have what we have now, the grills out there, you know. They would put up rocks and set their tubs on, and I don't remember how they got the water. I don't remember whether it came out of a hydrant or whether they got it out of the river. I really don't. But my brother and I used to ride the donkeys out there, and they didn't have too many animals when I was a child in the zoo, but what they had we liked. But the Sunday schools also would take, oh, and that is something that I haven't seen in 40 years. And that is what they used to have on Alamo Plaza, those big tallahos, we call them. It was a big truck, and the seats ran across. Oh, and as many as 8 or 10 could sit across. And, for instance, one of these tallahos could carry, say, 40 or 50 people. And they would take us to Brackenridge Park for a picnic. And we would go those winding trails, you know, and sometimes we'd think, oh, those trees, you know, we're in the middle of the road. And we, kids, Sunday school kids, you know, we were kind of small. Oh, we were just sure that we couldn't get by it, and we'd all scrunch over, you know. But we, Marley, had a wonderful time when I was a child. It was, I don't know whether I was ever a child or whether I never grew up, or there has never been any difference between my growing up and always, here I am, an old 69-year-old lady, you know, and I really don't, sometimes I feel all 69 years, but most of the time my heart is just as young as it always was. I can't explain it to you. I don't know whether other people my age feel this way, because I talk to some of them, and, some of them have such quavery voices, you know, and this is something that I don't quite understand in age. I don't understand that. But when you live in a place like San Antonio and you see it grow up, when you see these buildings go up, when Stowers on the corner of Main Avenue and Wolf and Marks on the corner of Main Avenue and Houston Street there, why, those were skyscrapers to us. We just thought those were the tallest buildings and the most beautiful, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, and how we did love to go to see when they were building them. My great-grandfather was a doctor, and I had to right now have a diploma that he got from Philadelphia School of Medicine, and it's in 1853. And then I also have another commendation, I guess you'd call it, framed. When he was in Louisiana at this time, this was the Civil War time when he was there, he was instrumental in conquering the yellow fever there. And so he was called to Washington to receive this commendation. And I don't quite understand how many years he went to college, because I'm just thinking back on something that came up. Well, my great-grandmother, in 1928, some reporter from Austin went out to her house to interview her because she was one of the early settlers to come to Austin. And when I read this in the paper, it's the Austin Statesman, she came to Austin with her father and her family in 1848. So in 1849, she was about 15 or 16 at that time, showing that young folks were just as daring way back there as they are today. She said that the young people were supposed to be at choir rehearsal. And instead of being at choir rehearsal, they all decided that they were going out to this treaty oak. And it was one of five trees in a grove of five trees where Indians used to meet and used to have their councils and their rituals. And of course, these young Texas people, they just decided that they would go and see it for themselves. Now, this was afternoon. They were going to choir rehearsal in the afternoon. And her brother was along with her and some other young people. And among them was my great-grandfather. But they were not even, I don't even suppose, sweethearts at that time. But he happened to be in the group. And when they got back, of course, it was dusk by the time they got back. And her father was a judge. And she says here that was the worst scolding that she ever got, and I presume that her father never raised his hand against her. Evidently, it was just a scolding. But he was very upset when he found out that his own son had a derringer in his pocket, and also my great-grandfather, this Richard Smith Morgan, also had a derringer. Now, the Indians, no doubt, were still up there somewhere, but they didn't see them. But my great-grandfather said those young people had no business out there by themselves. They should have had an adult with them, and they didn't have an adult with them. So, when my great-grandmother gave this interview in 1928, She was nearly 90 years old then. So she lived to be 98, and my grandmother, her daughter, lived to be 87. So whether I'm going to live a long life or not, because my mother died, you see, when she was just 31. But that actually had nothing to do, you know, with the... she had a disease, and that's the reason she died. The one thing I remember as a child, the neighborhood that I was in, we called... I don't know why we called it that, because I was a child, but everybody called it that, was the cultural neighborhood. The cultural neighborhood. And, of course, this is something that your mother wouldn't even remember. I don't think she would, because she wasn't Texan, you know. But that was Mrs. Eli Hertzberg. Now, Mrs. Eli Hertzberg, her husband founded the Hertzberg Jewelry Store, and you know where that is, on Houston and St. Mary's. Well, anyway, she was Jewish, and oh, she was a beautiful woman. And she used to live on Euclid, and that was where I passed her house every day, you know. And that little Jewish woman would be out in her yard because she loved children. When we were coming to school in the morning, she'd be there, and at noon when we'd go home for lunch, at 3 o'clock, if she was home, she'd be out there saying hello and what did you learn today and what are you doing, you know. She was real interesting. And she started the Chaminade Choral Group here in San Antonio. And they were women. And my cousin was in this group. And they just did beautiful numbers. And they're still in existence. Of course, Mrs. Hertzberg has been dead for many years, but the Chaminades still go on. And then she also founded the Tuesday Musical Club. And that was for musicians. They gave scholarships. And, of course, they have taken over her home now as a... that's where they hold their meetings now, is in her home. And when I was, married about... 6 or 8 years, a very dear friend of mine who lived on Slocum Place, where I had lived for so many years, which was across the street from Mayor McAllister's mother's home. And Mayor McAllister also lived on our, up 3 doors from where I lived. But his mother lived across the street. But this very dear friend of mine, Mrs. Richter, always bought tickets for me to go to the Tuesday Musical luncheons down at the Gutter or the St. Anthony. They would be at one or the other. And I loved to go because, sure enough, when I would go there, I would meet people, teachers that I had known in school way back in the first school I ever went to. And in the elementary school that I graduated from. But the first time I went, I saw this teacher, and I went up to her, and I said, "Miss Gould?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "I was in your class in the 4th grade over at No. 9 school." And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, yes." She said, "And I remember you, too. And I remember your brother, Ross." So the schools weren't so large in those days that they didn't, the teachers couldn't remember you after many, many years. Just think, that must have been then about 20 years or more. And, you know, a teacher was getting older. Then there was another year at that same Tuesday music, not at the same one, but another one. I met another old, and she was real old by then. And her name was Provines. And she had taught me in the sixth grade at this second school that I had gone to. And I said the same thing to her. I called her name. And I just looked at her and I said, "Do you know who I am?" And she could just look at me and look at my eyes and she'd say, "Yes, I remember. You are a Townsend." So our family did have these blue eyes, you know, that people would just seem to remember. And maybe most of us were talkers except this brother, this one 2 years older than I am. Both of my brothers have had their 50th wedding anniversaries. And the 9th of May, which is next Monday, is my 50th wedding anniversary. And so I guess I've lived a long, long life. I don't know whether any of this is really of any interest to you, but I hope that that it will be something that you will want to listen to someday. And I don't think you thought I could do it, but you just don't know how long I have given book reviews and things that I have just gone on and on. You really don't know how long I can talk without drinking water and all of that. I probably could talk 4 or 5 hours.
Well, I sure do thank you. It has just been wonderful and so interesting. That's the thing. It has been very interesting. I also will have a copy made of this and I'll give you a tape.
Well, I'll appreciate that for my grandchildren.
Thank you. Uh-huh.